All rise. Oye. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Sholin. To my left is Judge Bartley. We're here today in the matter of McCray against Wilkie, docket number 17-1875, to consider whether in denying service connection for hearing loss, the board may rely on medical opinion that relies on a 2005 Institute of Medicine report. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Thank you. Attorney Maxwell Kinman, representing the appellant.
Mr. Kinman, thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Villapando, along with my co-counsel, Emily Purcell, representing the secretary.
Mr. Villapando, welcome. Ms. Purcell. Are both parties ready to proceed?
On behalf of the appellant, yes, we are.
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Go on. Thank you. Mr. Kinman, you may proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the court, Maxwell Kinman for the appellant, Donald McCray. Your Honors, we appreciate the opportunity to present this matter. The first issue, before we can get to the other issues on appeal, is what evidence and argument can be presented after a joint motion for remand in this matter. The Secretary has argued that since this matter was previously remanded upon agreement of the parties, that the argument has to be limited to certain issues, issues that were brought up inside the joint motion for remand. On behalf of the appellant, we would ask that this court allow this appeal to go forward on all of the issues. And in support of that matter, we would point to the case law of this court, and we would ask for this court to issue a new rule that when a joint motion of remand is issued, the appellant may still make arguments regarding the same theory of entitlement. If the appellant was to make arguments regarding a different theory of entitlement that was not brought up in the joint motion for remand, then we would not argue that those arguments could be brought up. Here, this is service connection for hearing loss. The appellant had previously appealed to this court. He submitted argument after the joint motion for remand that the private medical opinion should hold weight. He also submitted argument after the joint motion for remand that the VA medical opinions were inadequate.
Were you counsel of record in that prior...
I was not, Your Honor.
You were not. And that was Brendan Garcia?
Yes, it was.
And he is with a completely different firm. That's not part of your firm?
Yes, I do not know Mr. Garcia. Okay. He's with a completely different firm.
Got
and
it.
After actually the last joint motion for remand, Mr. McCray was not represented by any attorney. So he was represented by counsel at the court, but then upon remand, he was represented again by the Texas Veterans Commission. So he, in fact, did not have counsel. However, he did submit argument after that joint motion for remand. And in those arguments, on record 22, he argued that his private medical opinion should be given great weight and that the other arguments that were brought forth, specifically about the medical opinions of the VA, should be downgraded. If this was a different claim, for example, if this was hypertension and a veteran had brought forth to the board that Agent Orange had caused the veteran's hypertension, and this went to a joint motion for remand, it was remanded for a procedural issue, then we would agree that that veteran could not bring a new theory of entitlement to the board. The veteran could not say, well, my post-traumatic stress disorder caused my hypertension. But here in this case, Mr. McCray has brought the same theory of entitlement from the beginning of the matter. He has asserted all along that his service, which is undisputed he was around all sorts of loud noises, that that service caused his hearing loss into the future. He's not asserting anything different. And those arguments have been the same from the beginning of the case.
Mr. Cameron, you indicated based on case law. Are you referring to Magid to support your position here?
For the Magid, Your Honor, also...
Isn't the point that the court has discretion?
The court does have discretion. And I think that's what's tripping us up as counselors, is that the court has discretion, and we don't have a bright-line rule here. We don't have anything to follow when we issue and we negotiate joint motions for remand. In cases like this, where this case... Last time it was in front of the court, the issue was the board simply completely ignored the private medical opinion. So the board didn't even mention the private medical opinion that was submitted. So the parties agreed rightfully that the board needs to at least discuss a private medical opinion that supported the claim. If this matter was not going to be issued or not going to be agreed upon in a JMR, then quite honestly, I think both sides would agree this court would have done the exact same thing. The court would have remanded the matter and said, Board, you need to address the private medical opinion.
The okay. issue. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question.
Yes.
That goes to the merits.
Okay.
Okay. Can you explain the perceived inconsistencies in the veterans' lay statements?
Yes, so the board simply attacks the veterans' lay statements, and the only evidence in support that the board uses is the lack of statements to his private medical provider between the years 2005 and 2008. So during those years, the appellant, it's 14 pages of records from record 909 to 923. This was basically wellness checkups the veteran had with his private physician. And in those wellness checkups, unfortunately, the private physician did not notate that the appellant had hearing loss and that did not notate that the appellant had any hearing problems. So based on those factors, the board, and I think this is important, for the very first time, the board questioned the appellant's credibility. So in the previous board decision and the previous years when this was before the agency, at no point was the appellant's credibility in question. So for the first time with this most recent board decision, They find him not credible simply because his private physician did not notate that he had hearing loss during those wellness checkups.
Well, didn't the, I can't remember the doctor's name, the whatever private doctor he saw between 05 and 08, those few records, did the doctor note normal hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. So the language actually used by the doctor in the notation was grossly normal hearing.
Uh-huh. And how does, do you have any idea how grossly normal hearing, if that means anything different than normal hearing?
We do not, and that's part of the problem is that, again, for the first time, the appellant is questioned with this at the board level. So he's unable to go back to his physician and say, can you please help us define what you meant by grossly normal hearing? Can you please clarify? Did you, you know, perhaps you just notated into your records and this is not something that you actually examined me for? And the problem we see here is that, again, for the first time, not in the previous board decision, but in this board decision, the board specifically questions the appellant's credibility, and there's no way for us to go back and correct it. There's no way to fix this. We can't get an affidavit and submit it to this court. We can't do anything because the record is closed. One thing that certainly could happen is, to answer your question, Judge Bartley, the appellant would be able to go back to his private physician and ask him or her to define exactly what you meant by grossly normal hearing, if it was even measured at the time. Because perhaps it wasn't. We all know that medical doctors, they use computer programs mostly when they dictate or when they make notes. And certainly this could have just been a standard form where it was checked off the box. He was not going in specifically for a hearing problem or tinnitus. I think on one of the visits he went in for a basketball injury. So obviously the visit was more focused in on his injury and his blood pressure and his hypertension and other issues.
Mr. Kinman.
Yes, Your Honor.
There is no dispute in the record that Mr. McRae did not have the assistance of hearing aids between 2005 and 2008, is there?
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree that he did not have hearing aids during that time.
But you maintain that he did have a hearing loss.
Yes, Your Honor. Based upon the appellant's testimony and his statements, he has had gradually worsening hearing loss since his time in service. And additionally, he had tinnitus as well. And that's not an issue here before the court, but he had both of those issues since his time in service. From the initial part of this hearing, we heard you, Chief Judge Davis, talk about the Institute of Medicine study that discusses hearing loss. And I would actually point you to this study because it is included in these records, and I believe it strongly supports Mr. McRae's arguments.
You mean an excerpt is included?
Yes, an excerpt. Okay. The entire study is not included, unfortunately, as part of the record before the agency. But what is included here is much more than what we get in most cases. Most cases and most VA examiners will just simply state that based upon this Institute of Medicine study, there is no such thing as delayed onset hearing loss. I would point this court to the record at 153, where the Institute of Medicine study discusses Chapter 2. And the quote is simply that young adults with a slight noise-induced high-frequency hearing loss, 15 to 30 decibels at 6,000 hertz, one not likely to cause much difficulty with communication if present at the time a young adult might be discharged from the military, will likely exhibit greater hearing loss as they age than young adults with normal hearing loss. So actually what this study says is, yes, there's no specific support for delayed onset hearing loss, but when you look at young adults that have not hearing loss for VA purposes, but they have a 15 to 30 decibel hearing loss, which would not qualify for VA purposes, but when they have that hearing loss, they are much more likely than the general population to suffer hearing loss as they age. And that's exactly what's happening here. The appellant during service had audiograms that show hearing loss. He had three of them, one of which showed he had perfect hearing, and two of which showed he had worsening hearing loss after exposure to noise.
Did you assert or point to that section of the IOM report in your briefing? I thought you argued that the section that discusses that there was not a lot of studies was the basis for your assertion of the inadequacy.
Yes, so there's two arguments in regards to the inadequacy.
So this is a new one?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the other would be that the report itself is just simply not enough. It doesn't. It says there's no studies that have been done to show delayed onset hearing loss. There is one study that involved gerbils at the time, but unfortunately that study, I would hope this court would find to be inadequate. And, you know, we do have case law to support it as well. We have Wise versus Shinseki, where, you know, the board had multiple theories or multiple experts, multiple reports, and the scientific community was in doubt. The secretary, in their brief in this matter, says that the IOM report can be interpreted to either support or challenge the audiologist's view of the report. Such review is outside the court's scope of review. When the secretary is saying that this IOM report can be interpreted either way, that should be a signal that the IOM report cannot be relied upon. And that if the VA and the secretary is going to say, well, the IOM report can be interpreted in multiple ways, but we're going to use it to deny claims, that I think would fall squarely against this court's holding in Wise versus Shinseki, where when there's medical questions as to what actually a report says or it can be interpreted in multiple ways, and this proclaimant veteran system, I think the benefit of the doubt has to be given to the appellants.
Does Wise actually go that far, or was it more that there was a lack of competence on the face of the doctor's report, as opposed to there might be multiple readings and you're relying on the medical expert to interpret that?
I think in Wise there was a medical expert, and then there was a private medical expert that had a report, and they were both relying on that on competing medical reports.
But the VA medical expert said, "I don't know anything about psychology. I haven't taken a psychology course in 25 years since I was in med school," and I think that's what the court found compelling in Wise, that that on its face assertion of incompetency, thus overcoming the veteran not raising the incompetence of the examiner's ability to provide that exam.
And we would assert that's the same here. With this IOM study, the VA examiners in this case for Mr. McRae are not offering any independent medical anything. They simply are re- referring to the ILM study. The ILM study says there's no delayed onset hearing loss, period. That's it. There's no explanation as to how that would apply to this appellant. There's no explanation as to, when you read further into the report, was there any...
Doesn't the report also say that there is, when you look at the processes for recovery of noise exposure in early years, and also the understanding of anatomy and the way the cochlear and ear parts work, that it's unlikely that early onset hearing loss that resolves would later manifest?
That is what the report says, yes.
So there is other information in there that supports the idea of no delayed onset.
Right, and I think there's support in the study for both ways. I think there's clear support that there's no such thing as delayed onset based upon the physical realities of the inner workings of the ear. I think there's questionable evidence in there where the report says there hasn't been enough studies done. The one study that's been done has been on gerbils. And I think there's support the other way. We're referring back to Chapter 2, where some individuals that had hearing loss in the 30 decibel range, 15 to 30 decibel range, as they age, that then increases to the 40 to 60 decibel range. And I think that's exactly what the Secretary is saying, too, that this report, it can be argued in any which way you want. The issue is, do these VA medical examiners, do they have to provide that analysis, or can they just cite the one part of the section that works in support of their claim? Or do they need to actually connect the analysis of the report to the appellant here? There was no discussion of, well, the ILM report said this, but Mr. McCray had hearing loss in service. He at least had decibel readings, which is undisputed, that showed he was having increased hearing loss problems based upon his induction audiogram and his in-service audiogram. There was no analysis of that. It was just simply the finding, unless you have hearing loss qualified for VA purposes in service, then you don't get service connection. And that's what the VA examiners are saying. There's no such thing as delayed onset.
What about the independent medical opinion? In fact, as far as I can tell, the only independent medical opinion of record is from the private physician.
And I agree. And I think that's very important. We have a medical opinion that was provided free of charge, was completely independent, did not know the appellant, is not the treating physician of the appellant, did this because the treating physician actually had her father, I believe, served. And the VA says, well, that's not good enough. And actually, the examiners say, well, we can't rely on that because we don't know how the private medical opinion was performed. If it was performed in the same settings as compensation and pension examinations. And I would assert to this court that is not enough to downgrade a private medical opinion.
Well, didn't they have an additional reason in that Dr. Cottle said that the veteran used amplification? I don't know that she mentioned hearing aids, but assuming those are the same thing, that he used some kind of amplification immediately after service. And has Mr. McCray, didn't he say at one point that he did not use hearing aids prior to 09 or 010?
Yes, I don't think there's any dispute in the record whether or not he used hearing aids prior to then. The private medical opinion mentions amplification. To be quite honest, we don't know what that is. We don't know in the record. We don't know whether that was at the time, this was a long time ago, a cone that was sticking outside of the ear to amplify the noise. We don't know if it was some other sort of assistive device, but the record is clear it was not hearing aids at the time. And I don't think that makes the medical opinion insufficient. The private medical opinion had an audiogram performed. The private medical examiner outlined the appellant's significant in-service noise exposure and the lack of post-service noise exposure, which none of that is in dispute.
But assuming that we would interpret amplification as not inconsistent with some kind of hearing device, aka a hearing aid, doesn't her inclusion of that, which seems to be in error, or at least inconsistent with what he later said about using a hearing aid, wouldn't that affect how the board, how persuasive the board found her opinion?
Well, I certainly think it would be a factor to consider. But the, you know, the board asked the VA examiners to determine why, or whether there was an addendum opinion provided by the VA doctors to basically counter and to see what they thought of the VA or the private medical opinion. And they focused simply on the fact that, not that the amplification wording or whether or not there was hearing aids at the time, they downgraded the private medical opinion simply because they couldn't determine whether or not it was completed at a VA facility, or they couldn't determine if the standards were the same as a compensation and pension examination.
Doesn't that matter more as to the right ear than as to the left, though?
Well,
because it's about the level of hearing acuity that the audiometry results showed.
Yes, and we do have a dispute here as to whether or not the right ear is qualifies for hearing loss. So I think that argument.
So I think they were potentially focusing on that. But it doesn't, the idea of whether a veteran used hearing aids or amplification or not, it seems to be a factual determination that doesn't require a medical opinion to say that that was a wrong statement.
Right, and there's nothing in the private medical opinion that shows the examiner relied on that fact. There's nothing saying, she didn't say, in fact, it was a long, detailed opinion. She did not say, well, you know, this is related to service because he used amplification after service.
What would you describe as the main crux of her opinion? What did she? You're saying she didn't rely on the that perhaps just a minor misstatement about the use of a device soon after service. What was the main thrust of the opinion?
Counsel, before you answer
question,
I need to add a few minutes to your time. Don, could you add 5 minutes, please?
Thank you.
You may proceed.
I think the main crux of her argument is there is a current hearing loss disability. There is, he served in the artillery in service. There is, this is not just small amounts of in-service hearing or noise exposure. This was significant in-service noise exposure. Additionally to that, she reviewed the audiograms that were in service that showed there was increasing problems with the appellant's ears, with the ability to hear and function. And based upon those factors, and perhaps most importantly, the complete lack of post-service hearing loss or post-service noise exposure, she made a professional opinion that the current hearing loss is related to service. You know, I hate to say this, it's not the most complicated case in the world for a medical examiner. It almost belies common sense that if your only noise exposure is howitzers going off 10 feet from you and artillery shells being shot and engines and no hearing protection and there's no other anything in your life that's noise exposure, I think the audiologist made her opinion based upon those factors and not whether, you know, it occurred immediately after service or 5 years after service or in the 2000s. I think that would be irrelevant, and I think based upon a fair reading of that report, it would show that those facts are irrelevant as well.
I'd like to ask you a question about your argument regarding Hensley and that it undermines the board's ability to decide the way it did. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Your Honor. The Hensley matter for the In regards to the board comment or the board making the credibility determination on the first instance?
Well, I thought you asserted that Hensley's statement about not being able to deny solely because of normal audiometric results at separation was that the board, I didn't think it was in the context of credibility, but I thought you were making that as a separate argument, that somehow they couldn't just rely on the IOM report because it was inconsistent with your reading of Hensley, but...
Yeah, it was in the IOM part of,
I think that is, again, I think it's because the only factor that they're pointing to is this report, and they're using that report to completely downgrade the the lay statements of the appellant and the appellant's spouse. And I think that would, in terms of how it interacts with the decision in Hensley, would be a problem.
Doesn't Hensley contemplate that a veteran, to me, basically Hensley is saying that you can't deny a veteran benefits because they had a normal audiometry reading at separation, that they have the ability to submit sufficient evidence to establish their case. But the veteran still has to submit sufficient evidence to establish hearing loss. So if the board, let's say, appropriately found that your client didn't meet their burden of proof, then there would be no Hensley violation, right?
If this court found that the board properly discounted the private medical opinion and gave that no probative value and discounted the lay statement of both the appellant and the appellant's spouse, then yes, I would agree with that statement.
Okay, thank you.
Well, wouldn't we also have to find that the Trotter opinion was probative against his claim?
And, Your Honor, I apologize. I'm trying to recall the opinion in Trotter specifically.
That's the three, the audiologist, the VA audiologist who gave all three opinions.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That's why I didn't know it. the court would have to find that the VA audiologist, I apologize if you could restate your question.
Yeah, just wouldn't we have to find that they properly downgraded? I mean, this is not as to Hensley in particular, but in order to get anywhere, we would also have to find that the board had properly relied on the Trotter's opinions, or the latest, at least the 2016, as adequate.
Well, yes, certainly, and if I could finish as my time is expiring, yes, I think that is what would have to be found, that number one, the VA audiologist is reliable, and this court could rely on the VA audiologist to discount the private audiologist, and that those opinions, as they stand on their own, are adequate as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Villalpando, I will add 5 minutes to your time if you need it.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Your Honors, may it please the Court. This Court should affirm the June 9, 2017 Board decision for the following reasons. There is no competent probative evidence that appellant had delayed onset hearing loss, such as his claimed hearing loss disabilities related to service. Appellant asserts that the positive January 2013 private medical opinion supports his claim. However, the board properly explained why it dismissed that opinion, namely in part that the examiner had relied on the fact that he had worn amplification devices, or if we've seen hearing aids, immediately following service, which is contradicted by the evidence of record, namely specifically in October 2009 VA audiology consult, where he had reported he had not been wearing hearing aids, which is found on record at 577. Even if the court were to find that the board somehow improperly discounted that positive opinion, that medical opinion still does not endorse delayed onset hearing loss, such that any theory that appellant has that this opinion does provide it cannot be derived from this opinion, and the court cannot impute information into this private opinion that's simply not there.
Mr. Villalpando, is there any additional information in the record aside from that reference to hearing amplification that supports the credibility concerns that the board has?
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the credibility determination of appellant when assessing whether he is credible to determine as to his reporting that he had continuous hearing loss since service, the board had considered the private medical records from 2005 to 2008, where he was specifically examined, and in that examination he was asked if he had any ear problems, to which he denied, as well as having grossly normal a notation there that said that it was grossly normal hearing, so which would cut against that the board found would cut against his credibility in that regard as to continuity of symptoms.
The appellant states that he wasn't asked if he had hearing problems. Do you know for a fact that he was?
Based on the reading of the record, what it says is that he was denied having ear problems. To state that appellant that what is required to properly dismiss his reporting of hearing loss in service would essentially be asking for affirmative negative evidence to say that I denied hearing loss, I do not have hearing loss, but we believe that that is not required, especially in this particular case where the facts in the record show that he was asked about any sort of hearing problems. It's entirely reasonable to say that he would have any hearing problems if he was asked about his ears, and then he was also provided an examination where he was grossly normal hearing, and such factors can be the board is allowed to consider, as the courts had held in Buczynski.
What does grossly normal hearing mean, and is its meaning anything different than someone just saying normal hearing?
What we see grossly normal hearing, regardless of whether we're trying to find how we can qualify how normal that hearing is, I think the issue here really is it still doesn't say that he is suffering from hearing loss at that time. So this is post-service records. This is decades after his service where he is at least not reporting that he's having any sort of hearing loss. And when examined, the physician did not appear to find any issues with his hearing.
And so as to my question about what does the addition of grossly mean there?
I cannot make a factual finding to say or try to qualify what that means, but all I could just say is that what it also does not say is that he has any hearing loss. So I'm not sure if the qualification there would have any sort of specific relevance to the issue here, but what we're saying is that what we're finding is that he has reported having continuous hearing loss, but these records do not indicate that to be the case. The only remaining probative The only other remaining probative evidence in the record then is against appellant's claim, and that would include the VA medical opinions that the board found were adequate. And such finding is a plausible basis in the record and is not clearly erroneous.
Now, as to those opinions, I'm looking at, they were very similar, only each additional, each fresher one added a few additional items. The most recent one I'm looking at on page 40 of the record, the second sentence of the actual opinion.
Turning to it, Your Honor.
Yeah, so the first sentence is review revealed normal hearing upon enlistment and separation with no threshold shifts. The second sentence, there were two audiograms, 1176 and 1276, found in the STRs that found transient hearing loss. Is that an accurate statement?
If the examiner believed that that's the case, then he's recalling what is being said in the STRs. What is also said in those STRs is that the what is what the VA examiner had also considered, which was that there was some hesitation, repeating half words, slow responses, behavior was repeatable, to which the examiner, as a medical professional, reviewed that record and found that this would be highly suggestive of questionable or non-organic results.
Yeah, but my question was the second sentence, that there were two audiograms found in the STRs that found transient hearing loss, and I'm just emphasizing the word transient. Is that an accurate statement?
I cannot contest what the examiner specifically as to that specific finding, but reading the examiner's report as a whole, that examiner then continued to provide an explanation as to what is in those, what those readings might mean.
Do you know
she is referring to record at 1037 there.
Yes, Your Honor.
So does the word transient appear there on 1037? Because she's saying that it does.
I can consult the record once. That record does not indicate the specific use of the word transient.
Okay.
In there.
Mr. Villalpando, what does transient hearing loss mean, if you know?
I don't, as what an audiologist would define it, I would not be competent to be able to speak to that. If I were to look at the plain meaning of the word transient, I would say that would be not permanent. And the examiner, based on the examination report, had reviewed his medical history to see that there was normal hearing at entrance and at separation, and also specifically addressed these records that the examiner had looked at to perhaps characterize it as transient hearing loss, but then explained away what potentially that data must have meant.
So the examiner noted that there were two audiograms shortly. This is actually during service.
Yes, sir.
That indicated some hearing loss from the service records. But as I read that report, there is a conclusion that says a veteran's hearing was clearly normal upon separation from active duty. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Okay. What we'd emphasize here is that the examiners here, with regard to the medical opinions provided, had reviewed appellant's file, found a normal hearing exam at separation, as well as considered the IOM report. We find that none of this would be prohibited. None of this is prohibited from as what Hensley would describe. This does not prohibit or limit an examiner from relying on such records, especially a normal separation examination that simply precludes the board from denying the claim outright solely because there's a normal hearing examination at separation, which is what did not happen here in this case.
Did the VA examiner provide any sort of analysis of applying the IOM report language that they quoted to Mr. McRae specifically?
The examiner had specifically just considered and said that they had considered, or at least made reference to, the IOM report as to its meaning, and reading the rationale, and included that in their rationale as to finding why it was less likely than not that the hearing loss was not related to service.
Did they address the other passages that your opposing counsel points to?
They did not specifically address it, but presuming, as the courts have held, that we can presume that VA examiners are competent, they have competent, and in relying and referencing on the IOM report, that would be, we can include it in that presumption. They can presume to have considered the entirety of that IOM report, as well as understand them with their medical expertise and experience to understand and be able to interpret the conclusions and opinions provided in that IOM report.
What was the basis for your assertion in your brief that the findings of the IOM report are outside the scope of the court's review?
Yes, what we see is that in an IOM report, which is a medical treatise, can only be interpreted by a medical professional, meaning that they can read it and also take the data and make conclusions and opinions regarding that IOM report. And that is something that a lay person cannot do themselves. If we were to take then to in this instance to then look at the language of the IOM itself at this juncture and to say that that the IOM report actually means something else, then that would be fact finding in the first instance.
What if a report said there is no association with this, and a doctor said there is an association with this? Is that something we would not be allowed to review? or find that the doctor erred or the board erred in accepting what the doctor said?
Right. The board's review would be for clear error, which would then look at the board's adequacy determination of these medical opinions. It's a court can certainly look at the data and at least read what it says to look for if there's any clear error. In that regard would be perhaps an example that you've provided, a direct clear misquoting of a report or something that is completely contradictory to what an examiner is saying. But that's not what is happening here in this case. So nor has appellant, for another example could be for if appellant provided another a medical opinion where the person said, no, the data is more recent data shows something else, or I have read the IOM report and I don't see this to be the case. But that's, again, these are certain scenarios that are not here in this case.
So let's just say the second scenario that you talked about, that a VA exam relied on an older exam or older medical treatise, and the appellant rebuts with a otherwise thorough reviewed service records, examined the veteran, and relied on more recent data, and VA still thought that the VA doctor's exam was more probative. Is there anything that the veteran can do in that circumstance?
I mean, that would have to look, the veteran would have to look at the assessment of the probative value of these competing opinions and to see whether the board had adequately addressed either of those opinions and explained why it is discounting what would appear to be a favorable opinion.
Let's assume for a moment that the IOM report is not in the picture. What else would the board rely on here to arrive at its conclusion?
Well, it is relying on the VA medical opinion. If you're saying that the examiner is not reviewing or considering the IOM report,
right,
then the VA examiner is considering the evidence of record, reviewing appellant's file, as well as their medical expertise in forming an opinion,
which they can do. Which would include a private medical examination report and several VA reports, if I recall. Is that correct?
Right. The board, subsequent to a JMR, had ordered the VA medical examiner to at least address the private medical opinion, which is the case here, as noted in the June 2016 medical opinion.
Yeah. And what were the problems with the private medical opinion?
There were a number of issues, but particularly with how the board had assessed it. The board had specifically addressed how there was a notation about an amplification using hearing aids in service, which I had said before was contradicted by the evidence of record.
Mm-hmm.
The examiners had also considered it it's unclear what protocol was used to provide the data, as well as the fact that this data is sitting in between a 2010 examination and a December 2013 examination. So this opinion that was provided, the January 2013, it's sitting in the middle, and it's unclear how basically the examiner isn't explaining why there's an aberration here.
Do we know what the amplification was?
It's unclear from the record what exactly is amplification in this context, but it is something that the private examiner had believed that he had worn, and therefore had opined that he's essentially had this hearing loss in service. So again, it doesn't speak to delayed onset hearing loss whatsoever, where the examiner had presumed that he had had this hearing loss in service.
Well, the veteran doesn't assert he had delayed onset. The veteran asserts he's had hearing loss all along. So the private examiner's theory matches up with the veteran's assertion. It's only VA that's arguing that it's delayed onset and that there cannot be delayed onset.
But then the record itself also is explaining that if he has no hearing loss soon after service, then the only next step theory as to his current hearing loss disability would be that it would have to be delayed onset hearing loss if there's no continuity of symptoms.
Well, he argued there were. VA found him not competent to do so. It's not clear to me why a layperson wouldn't be competent to assert that they've had hearing loss since service. So I'm kind of wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. Why? What is the basis for VA making a determination of what is outside the realm of common knowledge of a layperson to observe? And what's our review of that determination?
Yeah, the review of that determination, to start with your second part, would be for clear error. The board is competent, found that he was competent, not competent, rather, to provide a nexus opinion as to saying that his hearing, current hearing loss is related to service. That's what the competency determination is, that is what the board had
made.
But
if he had the same hearing loss since service, couldn't a continuing symptoms type theory be sufficient without actually demonstrating nexus?
It could be sufficient, but then the board then assessed the credibility of that theory, where he said that he had continuous hearing loss.
Right,
service,
but that's a separate reason. They didn't say because, I mean, that had to do with credibility. That didn't have to do with competence. I'm just concerned with the idea that a person can't say, I can't hear. That seems as obvious as I have a bone sticking out of my arm, or other things that the Federal Circuit has found are within the realm of what something a layperson could hear.
Sure, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but what I see as the board had discussed is that it's talking about the competency of appellant being able to provide, to be able to explain a relationship, an existing relationship, to say, not necessarily that he's not competent to say that I have hearing loss post-service.
Mr. Filippondo, is there any inconsistency between the government's position here with respect to the use of the IOM and Hensley, which allows, obviously, for even if you had normal hearing loss, the service member could show direct connection to some event in service to get where he wants to go?
Yes, Your Honor. We don't see an inconsistency with whatever the findings are of the IOM report and Hensley. And Hensley is talking about what the board is precluded from doing. We don't see the Hensley as endorsing an idea that VA must accept delayed onset hearing loss as an existing thing. It mainly explains that the board just cannot deny a claim solely because there's normal hearing exam at separation. What Hensley does not do, however, is to allow an examiner to review the file, which also happens to have a normal hearing loss at separation. So it's appellant is certainly able to provide sufficient evidence to demonstrate that, and it's not Hensley does not preclude them from doing so, but that's not what is happening here in this case in terms of supporting evidence.
I'm unclear why there's any support for finding that this is delayed onset hearing loss occurred here, because I'm just looking at Dr. Trotter's opinion again. The IOM said that the IOM concluded that based on current knowledge, noise-induced hearing loss occurs immediately, and he did have hearing loss immediately after trauma in service, right?
I cannot concede that, considering that if you're referring to the service records that talk about, that show audiograms that would suggest that he had what the examiner had characterized as transient hearing loss, and the examiner had then explained away what could be the possible...
The examiner didn't characterize that as transient hearing loss. The examiner said that the STRs characterized the audiograms as transient hearing loss, and when we looked at that record, we didn't find the word transient there.
And the record also doesn't suggest that it's unclear whether that hearing loss that is there is specifically due to trauma as well in service. That record also doesn't indicate that information.
Well, would it matter?
Well, he has hearing loss. I mean, wouldn't those audiograms on 1037 or whatever page it was,
sure,
don't they meet the standard of 3.385?
If you're looking at the raw numbers, they would. But again, what the examiner had done was reviewed that record and then also read the fact that that separation.
Can you just clarify which examiner you're talking about here?
Dr. Schroeder. Yes, in June 2016. Dr. Schroeder had reviewed that record, which also had indicated that there was normal hearing loss at separation, hearing at separation. So logically follow, the next thing is if we're looking at his current hearing loss then, if he didn't have hearing loss as what the examiner had found upon separation from service, then that would mean that whatever hearing loss he's complaining about, they would have to consider whether this would be some form of delayed onset hearing loss.
Well, but, I mean, you seem to be saying that it's Dr. Trotter who called these STRs transient hearing loss. Is that your, even though it doesn't read that way, let me just say that, but that's your view, is that it is Dr. Trotter herself who is calling the 1976 audiograms transient hearing loss?
Yes, in her medical capacity, she's reviewing the record and found it and characterized it as such, yes.
The opinion does not read that way. It reads as though, as I made clear earlier. But anyway,
sure,
we'll move beyond that. Nevertheless, her calling it transient hearing loss, I'm conceding for the moment that that was her talking and not her observation of what the STR actually said. Her calling it transient hearing loss, doesn't that correspond with what the IOM says, which is that based on current knowledge, noise-induced hearing loss occurs immediately?
You could look at and interpret, I mean, if you were reading as a layperson, the interpretation, it could be interpreted as such, but I don't believe that that is what the main issue here is what she was looking at, due to the fact that he left service without any hearing problems. So then, now that he's asserting that his current hearing loss is related to service, the examiner needs to find, okay, if there is anything in service that would have caused then this hearing loss many years after service. I think that's what the issue was that the examiner was trying to resolve.
Well, should the examiner at least have discussed that, the fact that based on the record at 1037, he did have immediate hearing loss after trauma?
We believe that the reference to that record in the opinion was sufficiently addressing that record, that STR. And this is, that's what we'll say about that.
Let me just make sure I understand what you just said. You said you believe, based on the examiner's explanation, that matter was addressed. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Going back to the IOM report, in the second finding in the record at 50, it says that studies haven't been performed to determine whether exposure to loud noises can cause delayed onset hearing loss. Because there isn't definitive scientific evidence addressing this question, is it error for the board to accept a VA exam that relies on the absence of evidence on this issue?
No, Your Honor. We don't see, first, that the IOM report is simply relying on the absence of evidence, which would make it like a circular type of thing to say that we've made a 339-page report to say that because there's no evidence, there is no sufficient evidence. That's not what we see.
Well, they do that all the time. They say we looked at all the evidence and there's not enough to draw a conclusion from this. They do that in the National Academy of Sciences does that in the Agent Orange reports every time they issue a report.
I can't speak for the other reports, but in this particular report, if we're looking at the three-page excerpts of what is included in the record, what the IOM is stating, sorry, I lost my train of thought, is that it's not just simply an absence of evidence. If you're looking at the IOM as well, there is also discussions about how how the studies are also based on anatomical and physiological data to show that recovery process that available on the recovery process following noise exposure that is unlikely that delayed effects occur, as well as based on the understanding of the mechanics and processes involved in the recovery from noise exposure, suggests that daily that a delay in many years is extremely unlikely. So looking at all of that, we don't read that the IOM report is simply just relying on an absence of evidence here to make an ultimate conclusion.
Now, I noted in Dr. Cottle's opinion, she phrased her opinion as the hearing loss, his current hearing loss, acoustic trauma in service either caused or contributed to his current hearing loss. Did Dr. Trotter address the contribution, of the in-service trauma, not in terms of causation, but in terms of a possible contribution? Given the fact that he didn't have any, he went to college and then he worked in, did office work for many years after service. So we don't know that he had any exposure. It doesn't seem as though he had any other acoustic trauma exposure. And also, he wasn't that old when he got the diagnosis of hearing loss, even though, he says he's had symptoms all along. Anyway, did she address contribution at all?
Dr. Trotter did not specifically discuss contribution, but again, because the private examiner had used the words contribute, it's not clear that that also would reasonably raise the issue of if what you're saying is aggravation, if that's something that was required that needed to be addressed, meaning that that he had, if it was contribution, that would mean that there would have to be some hearing loss that already had existed. Again, that's something that it's not shown by the record, especially deemed that considering that in the entrance exam he had a normal hearing examination. So I don't see that being an issue with the VA medical opinions.
Would the only theory under which such an idea would fall would be aggravation of a pre-existing hearing loss, or could he also just under general service connection principles be service connected for an in-service event that contributed to his current disability?
Before you answer that, counsel, would you have 5 minutes? Go ahead.
If that wasn't clear, my main thing is you immediately jumped to aggravation.
Okay.
And my question was, do you have to jump to an aggravation theory here, or can you just use a regular direct service connection or delayed direct service connection theory to address whether his in-service acoustic trauma contributed to his current hearing loss?
I don't see how the use of the word contribute would need to be addressed in direct service connection theory, especially if contribute, as I said before, it means that it's something that's it's assisting or further worsening the hearing loss in that case, which would then mean that there's already a pre-existing hearing loss that's there that it would be contributing to. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, then the Secretary respectfully requests that this Court affirm the June 9, 2017 Board decision where the only competent and probative evidence of record is against the appellant's claim. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, please, the Court again.
We've had a lot of discussion here this morning about the IOM report. And again, I'd like to reiterate on behalf of the appellant that report says that noise-induced hearing loss occurs immediately. The report doesn't say anything about how long that hearing loss stays. Here we have an appellant, a veteran, with hearing loss on two different audiograms during service. The report next says that there is no such thing as delayed onset hearing loss. But again, the report doesn't say whether hearing loss that occurs cannot then be aggravated or appear later on. And that's the analysis that is missing here. Instead, we have the VA examiner saying there is no such thing as delayed onset hearing loss. But that examiner doesn't account for the fact that that's not what the IOM report actually says. And in fact, the IOM report says that it occurs immediately. And it did occur immediately here. The private examiner also downgrades the opinion of the appellant's private audiologist. And in doing so, they don't comment on the hearing aids, whether or not the appellant had hearing aids prior or after service. Instead, on record 41, the VA examiner says, maybe the private audiologist does not know the limits of medical knowledge. Basically disputing that a medical examiner could ever determine that delayed onset hearing loss could occur. That's the only reason that the VA's own examiner downgraded the opinion, was simply because, well, two reasons. The private audiologist did not know the limits of medical knowledge, and that whether or not there was right ear hearing loss and the audiogram was adequate based upon whether it was performed under the same standards as a compensation and pension examination. So the VA examiners and the secretary would have this court believe that there is no such thing as delayed onset hearing loss, irregardless of whether hearing loss occurs after a traumatic acoustic event. We have a private medical opinion connecting Mr. McRae's hearing loss to service, and we have an IOM report that says noise-induced hearing loss occurs immediately, and that is exactly what happened here. We have that, we have the connection with the private audiologist, and we have the in-service records clearly showing that there is noise-induced hearing loss in service.
Doesn't the IOM report seem to contemplate recovery from that when they discuss the recovery processes as part of their understanding that there wouldn't be delayed onset?
Exactly. It discusses recovery, and then also, again, in Chapter 2, it discusses the fact that young adults about the same age as service members when they leave service, or the average age of service members when they leave service, may have quote-unquote hearing loss that they may not notice at the time because it's at higher frequencies, and that they are more than likely than the standard population to have full hearing loss later in life.
Right, but Mr. McRae had testing done at exit which didn't show hearing loss. So unlike potentially those people that they're talking to who had hearing loss, then got more hearing loss, as opposed to had some hearing loss, got better, and then have more hearing loss.
And I think that's the question that's left unanswered by the medical opinions in this case and by the IOM report itself, is that if there is hearing loss, does it get better? And if it gets better, does the prior hearing loss, the prior traumatic event, make you more likely to suffer hearing loss in the future? You know, we don't know when the IOM report discusses young adults who had a traumatic experience. The report doesn't say that their hearing loss stayed constant. There's no discussion of constant hearing loss in the report. What we have is that it occurs immediately. There's no discussion of how long it lasts or if it goes away or if it gets better. It's simply that it occurs immediately, but there's no such thing as delayed onset. And if the appellant, if Mr. McRae didn't have any hearing loss in service, if he was just stating that I was exposed to noises, but he had multiple audiograms with showing absolutely no hearing loss, I think then the VA examiners could properly rely on the IOM report to say, or at least to attempt to try to support their position, that there's no such thing as delayed onset hearing loss. And this veteran never had hearing loss, so it cannot be delayed onset. In Mr. McRae's case, he had hearing loss. And the IOM report says hearing loss happens immediately. The question that's left to answer, which the VA examiners do not do, is whether or not that hearing loss can come back. And with that, Your Honors, we would ask that this, if there's no further questions, of course, but on behalf of the appellant, he does appreciate the time that this court gives him. Thank you for allowing the argument. And we would ask that this court vacate the decision of the board and send this matter back down. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down to recounsel.
All rise.